Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Craig Mulkiber, former director of the New York Office of the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, who advocates a plan that the United Nations General Assembly could adopt to end Israel's ongoing genocide of Palestinian civilians in Gaza. Michelle Ruse of the Environmental Protection Network, made up of former EPA staff that are working to defend federal environmental regulations now being weakened or eliminated by the Trump administration. And Justin Glau, an independent journalist and editor of the American Doom newsletter, who discusses concern that Donald Trump could order the U.S. military to intervene and alter the outcome of the 2026 midterm election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Fighting in the mineral-rich Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, has escalated despite a ceasefire signed in the White House between M23 rebels and the DRC government, mediated by Qatar. According to Foreign Policy magazine, over 100 groups are now fighting for control of valuable mineral deposits in the contested region. In recent weeks, the Rwanda-backed M23 rebels launched an offensive violating the ceasefire in southern Kivu province, leading to over 300 civilian deaths. A second rebel group, the Allied Democratic Forces that are linked with Islamic State and formerly based in Uganda, launched attacks which killed over 50 people, kidnapped 100, and looted homes in northern Kivu province. Earlier this year, M23 rebels, with Rwanda's support, captured the key DRC cities of Goma and Bukavu. After occupying Goma for the past 6 months, an investigation conducted by journalists working with human rights organizations found that M23 had committed summary executions, mass arrests of young men, forced conscription, and a crackdown on dissent. After Hurricane Katrina nearly destroyed New Orleans and killed more than 1,800 of the city's residents 20 years ago, the federal response came under intense scrutiny. When the deadly hurricane struck on August 23, 2005, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, was unable to effectively respond due to policies enacted by former Republican President George W. Bush. After the 9/11 attacks, Bush had cut FEMA's budget and stripped the agency of its cabinet-level status. Soon after returning to the White House in January, President Trump and the Republican-controlled Congress have defunded key FEMA programs, laid off and retired over 1,000 staffers, 20% of the agency's workforce, and is threatening to dismantle the agency entirely. On August 25th, 182 current and former FEMA employees wrote to Congress, warning that the Trump administration's major cuts to the agency's budget and staff could lead to another catastrophe on the scale of Hurricane Katrina, while weakening the agency's ability to respond to floods, droughts, wildfires, and other extreme weather disasters related to the climate crisis. In the weeks after the surprise victory of Democratic Socialist Zohra Mamdani in New York City's mayoral primary, the Democratic Party establishment and donor class went into a panic as Mamdani ran and won on kitchen table economic issues. Mamdani's young progressive supporters were dismissed as pro-Palestinian progressives, not in tune with America's working class. But an analysis of polling data finds that Democratic Party officials, including House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, who have withheld their endorsement of Mamdani, are the ones out of touch with the nation's working class voters. While Democrats lost the 2024 election due to a loss of working class support, the Center for Working Class Politics recently reviewed decades of polling data and found that large majorities of working class voters are progressive on issues like raising the minimum wage and taxing millionaires. Two-thirds of working class voters favor limits on imports to protect jobs. On cultural issues, these voters are increasingly pro-choice, support LGBTQ rights, and oppose extreme measures on immigration enforcement like family separation. The report concludes that there is a winning constituency for candidates embracing populist economic policies and social progress, but too many Democrats aren't pursuing it. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The news from Gaza has only gotten worse in recent days, as attacks by the Israeli military have killed at least 54 Palestinians, part of a new offensive targeting northern Gaza that's caused large numbers of refugees to flee. The attacks came as Gaza health officials recorded another 13 deaths due to starvation, three of them children. That brings the number of hunger-related deaths in Gaza to more than 360. More than 60,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children, have been killed over the past 23 months since the October 7, 2023 Hamas terrorist attack on Israel that killed 1,200 and kidnapped 240 hostages. The world's leading authorities on genocide, the International Association of Genocide Scholars, declared on September 1st that Israel, by all legal definitions, is committing genocide in Gaza. As the Trump regime reviewed a plan to forcibly remove Gaza's 2.3 million Palestinian residents that envisions turning the territory into a U.S.-controlled economic hub with luxury resorts, the U.S. State Department has denied visitor visas to applicants who use Palestinian passports, including Palestinian diplomats who planned on attending this year's U.N. General Assembly meeting in New York City, September 9th through the 23rd. Your reporter spoke with Craig Mochiber, former director of the New York office of the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, until he resigned in protest due to the unfolding Gaza genocide. Here he describes a plan that the United Nations General Assembly could adopt, if it had the political will, to end Israel's ongoing genocide of Palestinians in Gaza.
The United Nations normally would be able to mandate a protection force to be deployed to save the survivors of genocide in Gaza and beyond on the West Bank. It has not so far been able to do so because the typical channel for this is in the UN Security Council, and the U.S., as a permanent member and a co-perpetrator in the genocide, uses its veto power to prevent anything from passing through the Security Council. And that's been very convenient for a lot of countries who say, well, you know, we tried, but the U.S. vetoed it. But a lot of these countries are hiding behind the veto because there is a mechanism in the United Nations that allows for countries to get around, to circumvent a veto of a permanent member of the Security Council when the Council is unable to act because of that veto and when there are serious issues on the ground that need to be addressed by the international community. This is something that is called Uniting for Peace. It is the name of a resolution in the General Assembly from 1950 that says specifically that when the Security Council is unable to act because of the veto, that the UN General Assembly itself, a body with no veto, where every country has one vote, can take action to address the situation. And indeed, there is a precedent because in 1956, the UN General Assembly mandated the UN Emergency Force for the Sinai over the objections of Britain and France, both permanent members of the Security Council, over the objections of Israel, and just used the permission of Egypt to actually enter on the ground in Sinai and interpose forces in the UN emergency force. It has not been done since. And the call now is for the GA to take up its responsibilities and to deploy a UN protection force for Gaza, ultimately to expand to the West Bank, but immediately to Gaza, to enter by land, sea, air, either through the Sinai and the Rafah entry, or using navies to enter at the Gaza beach, or to parachute in, whatever it takes to break the siege, to bring in UN-mandated forces, and to deliver humanitarian aid, to protect civilians, to preserve evidence of Israeli war crimes, and to begin the process of recovery and reconstruction. That is something that could be done. It is legal. There is precedent for it. There is a fair amount of political will on the part of member states that have voted in a supermajority of more than two-thirds to support Palestine and to oppose the Israeli onslaught. If they can be convinced to do so now, it could make all the difference in the world, particularly in what is the final phase of Israel's plan for genocide in the Gaza Strip.
Well, Craig, that's hopeful. One thing we've seen over the years, and certainly during the siege of Gaza, is that the Israeli military and the government that commands them has no problem at all with attacking United Nations forces, United Nations personnel, United Nations humanitarian aid workers. Would it not be a scenario in which a UN force could be organized to come to the aid of Palestinian civilians in Gaza or the West Bank, and certainly be targeted immediately by the Israeli military with possible backup by the United States?
Well, no one is naive about this proposal. We are all aware that Israel holds the world record by a wide margin for the murder of UN staff. Just in the last 22 months, it's murdered more than 360 UN workers in Gaza alone. It has a long record of attacking UN peacekeepers in the south of Lebanon with impunity. No one, you know, doubts the possibility of aggression on the part of the Israeli regime against this internationally mandated force. However, the hope is that the configuration of the force will act as a deterrent. So imagine a large force, which is made up of contingents from a number of countries from around the world, from various regions, European countries, Latin American countries, Asian countries, African countries, all under the UN flag, entering without engaging in combat with the Israeli regime, but strictly on a defensive civilian protection mandate to deliver food and to break the siege. Will it be so easy for Israel to act in military aggression against this force so mandated? It's not impossible. It's probably less likely than if you tried another form of intervention. And of course, the force would be accompanied by a diplomatic mobilization on the part of the whole world, with the exception, of course, of the most complicit states. The government of the U.S., we know, acts as a proxy for Israel within the Security Council and the broader UN. And so no one is expecting a principled position on the part of the U.S. government.
That was Craig Mokhiber, an international human rights lawyer and former director of the New York office of the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights. Find a link to his recent commentary titled, How the UN Could Act Today to Stop the Genocide in Palestine, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In 2017, when Donald Trump took office for the first time, a group of retired Environmental Protection Agency workers, from office staffers to agency heads, formed the Environmental Protection Network to support the essential work of the agency they loved that was then being threatened. The group began as an all-volunteer effort. In 2025, the network is now a nonprofit with 24 staff, as a second Trump administration, led by Trump's EPA administrator Lee Zeldin, is actively working to dismantle the agency. The number of volunteer members of the network, who lend their expertise to government agencies across the board, has now surpassed 700, including about 50 staffers who were fired or resigned over the past several months. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Michelle Ruse, executive director of the Environmental Protection Network, who talks about the group's origins and their current work to defend government regulations essential to protect human health and the environment.
So basically, in the wake of Trump being elected the first time, a bunch of folks, predominantly very recent retirees from EPA, but also political appointees that served under both Democratic and Republican administrations over the previous 20 years, got together in a living room in Washington, D.C. and said, what if this new Trump administration follows through on its various campaign promises? What if it pulls back, you know, from international climate change negotiations? What if it eviscerates EPA? What if it cuts its budget? What if it, you know, shuts down offices, doesn't follow science, et cetera? We should be prepared. And so what was, you know, a handful of meetings in different living rooms and very informal, it became very clear that the Environmental Protection Agency couldn't really speak for itself any longer. And so suddenly this group of people was an independent source of information and resources and enthusiasm for the mission and the importance of the Environmental Protection Agency's work. So in that spring, that March, they did a deep dive into the president's proposed budget, wrote a comprehensive 40-some-odd page paper, and talked a tremendous amount to reporters and congressional staffers to explain why this was a bad idea. And after that, they're like, wait, hold on a second, we are very useful. And they began the process of becoming a formal 501c3 organization.
Michelle Roos, in 2009, the Supreme Court ruled that EPA has the authority and the responsibility to regulate greenhouse gases in order to protect public health. That was called the endangerment finding. And now the Trump administration is trying to overturn that finding, which of course would have devastating impacts on public health. So is the Environmental Protection Network involved in trying to keep that from happening?
One of the things that we're doing is just making sure that people understand the severity of this. This repeal of the endangerment finding will lead to hundreds of thousands of premature deaths, increased asthma attacks, missed work days and school days from illness inspired by air pollution. It is devastating. It is something that we're not going to feel 30 years from now. This is something we're going to feel now. I don't know where you live, but I live next to a highway. I'm breathing in emissions all the time from cars, and it is indisputable science and fact that reducing those emissions leads to better health outcomes for all of us, particularly children, elderly, and people with existing health issues. And so I think big thing that we're doing is just making it very clear to folks across the country why this is so devastating and why the endangerment finding was so important. The second thing we're doing is we are still participating in the formal regulatory process and public comment process that agencies is currently following, which means that we showed up both formally as EPN, but many of our volunteers also spoke for themselves. We testified at a recent public hearing about the importance of this, and we are submitting comprehensive formal comments on this that we will be submitting to EPA before the end of the month. I believe the deadline's around September 22nd. So we are still participating in this process as an organization, as an NGO, but more importantly than all that, as folks that helped write the regulations that met the endangerment finding requirements. It's truly devastating, and I don't really understand how elected officials get away with doing things that are particularly devastating to their constituents. And I think a big part of this is, you know, we are all exposed to just a tiny sliver of information that is sadly structured in a way and delivered to us in a way through algorithms and other things to support what we already think versus revealing the facts. You know, as an organization that believes in the law, science, transparency, we got our work cut out for us.
That was Michelle Roos, Executive Director of the Environmental Protection Network. Learn more about the group and the Trump regime's attack on environmental and climate regulations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Donald Trump moves forward with his daily attack on the nation's democratic institutions, violates the Constitution and the rule of law, the twice-impeached president and his administration have launched a new phase in their plan to eliminate all checks and balances on executive power. Trump's plummeting approval ratings could pave the way for Democrats to win control of the House and Senate in 2026. In response, Trump and the Republican Party are now attempting to rig the midterm election through an unprecedented scheme of mid-decade gerrymandering that began in Texas by racially redistricting the congressional map to give the GOP 5 additional seats. Other Republican-controlled states, including Indiana, Missouri, Ohio, and Florida, are likely to join in the gerrymandering plan. Trump has also issued unconstitutional executive orders attempting to dictate how local and state elections will be organized, such as his recent edict to eliminate all mail-in ballots, and an earlier order requiring all voters to present proof of citizenship, such as a passport or a birth certificate. All this as the president has deployed the military to Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., while threatening to militarily occupy other minority-majority cities. A desperate Trump, fearful that a Democratic Party-controlled House would block his authoritarian agenda and initiate articles of impeachment against him for a third time, could employ the U.S. military to intervene in the 2026 midterm election to prevent a GOP defeat. Your reporter spoke with Justin Glau, an independent journalist and editor of the American Doom newsletter. Here he discusses these future threats, examined in his recent article titled "How Trump's National Guard Shock Troops Could Seize Voting Machines," and other concerns about the security of the 2026 congressional election.
That piece that I wrote is based on some, I think, extremely overlooked but really good reporting that came out in 2020 from Betsy Woodruff at Politico, where she got her hands on a never-issued executive order in which the Trump administration discussed seizing voting machines. I don't think I did a good enough job in the article pointing out that discussion and that plan, while it never came to fruition in the exact way that the executive order laid out, what did come to fruition was that some of the people involved with that executive order, people like Sidney Powell, people like Mike Flynn, who have these deep ties to the election denial movement, some of those folks did get their hands on voting machines in a place called Coffee County in Georgia. And it's never been really fully clear what they did with that information, although I've learned over the years that information which included a lot of data and information about how election systems work in Georgia was shared with sort of a murderer's row of some of the worst election denier type people that you would never want having their hands on that stuff, people like Mike Lindell and others. You know, so while the military never did actually go in and seize voting machines, Trump's people, for lack of a better term, eventually did get their hands on that equipment in Coffee County. The reason that I tied the recent actions with National Guard, those deployments, to that never-issued executive order was for obvious reasons, that they discussed having the military seize voting machines in an effort to prove fraud that would allow Trump to remain in power after he lost the 2020 election. And the reason that I think the National Guard is important to look at is there seems to be a willingness to be using the Guard in ways that maybe other divisions of the military are not being employed. The image of U.S. Army troops or U.S. Marines going into a voting center in my hometown or whatever to seize voting machines is almost like too difficult to even conceive of. But these National Guard folks that are being deployed everywhere, to me, this seems like there's less sort of checks and balances that would prevent something like that from happening.
What have we witnessed over these past 7 months of this second Trump regime that indicate that Donald Trump might go to great lengths, greater than he went during January 6th and inciting the January 6, 2021 insurrection, to prevent a change in control of the House or Senate
if the Republicans should lose control of those bodies in next November's election. And of course, there's a real concern that there are a lot of actions being taken, such as mid-decade gerrymandering that we see in Texas. We're going to probably see that unfold in other states. Taking it all together, Justin, what are the indications, do you think, that it's realistic to be concerned about Trump imposing some kind of blockade on the counting of the votes or manipulating the outcome of the election?
So many pieces of evidence. I could talk for an hour about all the pieces of evidence that allude to some very troubling scenarios going into the midterms next year, not the least of which are a handful of executive orders that Trump has issued regarding elections. Obviously, the big one is one that he issued essentially demanding that we do away with voting machines. And that was directed at an obscure federal agency called the Election Assistance Commission. But I would like to point out that this is not just like a top-down thing that's just coming from Trump or just coming from the White House. There's a lot of stuff happening at the Justice Department right now that can essentially be thought of as pre-election interference. The Justice Department is going around to pretty much every single state, and essentially what they're trying to do is to compile a nationwide database of voters and their personal information. And the Justice Department has not really said why they're trying to do that, and there's lots of theories about what that is. You know, there's also a scenario in which elections will still be held, but in communities that are majority-minority, like you pointed out, there could be a situation in which National Guard troops are all over black neighborhoods, that ICE agents and other law enforcement are all over Latino neighborhoods in essentially a widespread voter suppression effort with guns.
That was Justin Glau, an independent journalist and editor of the American Doom newsletter. Find a link to his recent article titled How Trump's National Guard Shock Troops Could Seize Voting Machines by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WXOJ in Northampton, Massachusetts, KPSQ in Fayetteville, Arkansas, KIDE in Hoopa, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.